Hi. Hello? Okay, I'm going to have to... This is a very talkative crowd, and that's a good thing. I know you're all eating your food, so we're a little bit behind schedule today, and so I'm going to ask you as you eat to try to keep the noise down of the clanking stuff. Focus on the noodles, maybe, and not the meat or something like that. My name's Tom Easton. I'm on the Professional Affairs Committee. I was a governor. This is a rare thing for me to do today. I'm doing it because we have the very, very rare opportunity of having a one of America's foremost researchers into the effectiveness of anti-poverty. Actually, why should I say America? One of the world's most foremost experts on this very, very important subject. Many of you are probably reporters in the room or work for some sort of NGO, but you may work for a private business too. I would say the alleviation of poverty is at the core of everything that all of us do. I started out working in factories and so forth in very poor areas. I've been a reporter now for 25 years, and the biggest mystery that I see is, why do things work? It is what animates everything that I write about, and I think there are a lot of people in my profession who see this exactly the same way. We are fundamentally intrigued and mystified by the question of, why do things work? Especially in the nonprofit area, where the goal really, or not nonprofit, in the poverty alleviation area, because I don't want to use the word nonprofit because I'm not really adverse at all for there being a profit. Why isn't poverty alleviation successful? What programs do work and what programs fail? How can one look at that objectively? These are, to me, the single most important issues, and therefore I applaud you as an audience for coming to this presentation, and like the rest of you, I look forward to hearing Professor Carlin's comments. As you know, there'll be about 20 minutes of him speaking. If you have questions, and I hope you do, attack Dean Carlin. He's used to it. He's a professor in an American university. Don't throw things at him, but throw your comments at him. The more lively the discussion, the better. I will try to recognize everyone in this room. So just gesture to me that you have a question, and I'll try to get to all of you. All right? Thanks a lot.
Oh, I already have water. Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. I really look forward to this, and I'm going to try to be brief so that we can have more conversations and questions. I think Tom put it perfectly, though, when he said one thing, which is the struggle is to learn why things work. I think you said it, I really like the way you said it, and in some sense that's a much better question to ask than, does it work? And the reason is simple, because we can't afford to ask the question, does it work, in every single program around the world. That's just a crazy high expenditure on evaluation. So we need to understand more about why things work, and then it's with that understanding of the why that we can then really start forming larger policies. Okay, so having said that, I just wanted to, that was not part of what I was planning to say, but he just said it so perfectly, I wanted to kind of make that point. So the book that I recently wrote, called More Than Good Intentions, has two basic themes to it. And the book, first of all, is not an academic book. It's intended very much to bring the work that we have done in academia and through our nonprofit Innovations for Poverty Action out to the world of people who are not reading academic journals and are not at the World Bank or the Gates Foundation, where we're engaged in conversations. The two basic themes to the book, one is about learning what works, what doesn't, and why. And the second has to do with the very focused on the why, understanding more about the individual decision-making process and how we can learn lessons about how individuals make decisions, both poor and rich, and how that can shed insight to the way we design programs. So let me talk about the two in step. So when we talk about, does it work? One of the things that's striking to me in this space of poverty alleviation, whether it be nonprofits or for-profits that are doing things that are making a claim about alleviating poverty, is whenever I'm in a new setting or meeting someone for the first time who knows the basic topic of what I'm doing, often the first thing they ask me is, okay, which camp are you in? There's this one camp that says aid is corrupt, aid doesn't work, it's all wasted, or even worse yet, does harm. And there's another camp that says, no, Here's things that work. We just need to spend more money. We need to motivate people to give more, either through bilaterals, multilaterals, individuals, and there's just programs out there and we need to expand them. And my answer to that is something that is so boring and moderate that it's hard to argue with, which is to say that the answer is about learning which programs work and which don't. That sometimes aid works and sometimes it doesn't. Right? And we're not going to have an answer to this question of does aid work that is simply yes or no. That's crazy. Right? Of course there's going to be some successes and failures. And the challenge is figuring out which is which and what the patterns are, going back to what Tom said, the why. The minute we can get inside the box on the why is the minute we have some greater lessons that we can take away and use to help set policies and know what types of things to do in new settings. So now, why has it been, what do we mean by learning whether something works or not? And that's the big change that we've seen happen in development economics in the past 10 years. So I started working in development in 1992. And a little story about how I got started, I think, gives you some insight into exactly what is it that we're doing differently than has been done in the past to ask this question, does it work and why? So when I was working in 1992 for a microcredit organization, a program in El Salvador that gave loans to women to start or expand enterprises. When I signed on, this was pre-internet days, and there was two basic statements made in a marketing material that I had received about this microcredit organization that excited me a lot. And it said, we are reaching women who are hardworking, fighting their way out of poverty, inspired, entrepreneurial, and we're giving them loans so that they can expand their business and then with that extra income from their business, provide for health and education for their children, et cetera, et cetera. So I went to El Salvador and I was working on the software side, the business side of the operations. And the first thing that struck me when I was there was learning a little bit more about how the program actually worked. And I was struck by the rigidity of some of the loans and how they were very highly structured. Get a loan and have to pay it back over exactly 16 weeks, but yet some of the things that people were saying the businesses were doing weren't going to be paying off income immediately. So, and I just spent 2 years of investment banking learning about how you want to match your assets and your liabilities. So this struck me as a little bit odd. The second thing that struck me as odd was that the interest rate was 72% a year. This is not what I had thought it was going in. And so I started asking myself and others, well, okay, at 72% a year, what is this enterprise doing? What is this magic opportunity that these individuals have that is making it so that borrowing at 72% is a profitable exercise, that their return on investment is even higher? So I asked this program, where's your evidence of impact? What studies have you done? And they showed me their impact studies, which at the time was just the same as everybody else. So I'm not picking on them by any means. And they consisted of asking people in the programs who had been with them for a couple years, are you eating better than you were 2 years ago? Are you healthier than you were 2 years ago? Is your business bigger than it was 2 years ago? And lo and behold, 90-so% said yes, yes, yes. And that was it. So let me throw out a fourth question that you could put on that same survey. Suppose that survey also said, are you older than you were 2 years ago? Okay, would we then conclude that microcredit caused aging? Right? That clearly would not. We know not to do that. So, the point is when you just follow people before and after, there's a lot of things that are happening that cause change over time. And let's divide it out into two types of things. One would be external factors like macroeconomic conditions, roads getting built, other NGOs, government services being provided. And these are causing people to do better over time or not, but they're causing change over time. Aging, time, causes aging, right? So the first thing you have to realize is to get at this impact question, to find out, does something cause something else? You have to ask the question, how have the lives changed of people in a program compared to how their lives would have changed had the program not existed? So what this evaluation had to do is not just follow the people who were in the program, but follow some people who were not in the program. So suppose they went out and they found a bunch of people who had not borrowed from this lending program. And they compare and they ask them those same four questions. Are you eating better? Are you healthier? Is your business bigger? Are you older? And what would they find? Well, they would find this comparison group got older by 2 years, so that would be equal and that was all good and well. And maybe let's say they found that the people who took out the loans were healthier, were more educated, their children more educated, and their businesses were bigger. Would we be satisfied now? So hopefully not. Now go back to that brochure I told you about and think about the first question that was on that brochure, the first statement on that brochure. Who was this program reaching? It was reaching hardworking women fighting their way out of poverty, inspired, entrepreneurial. Take a group of people who fit those criteria, and what do you think happens to them over time compared to people who don't fit that criteria? They do better. So that's kind of almost what we mean by those terms, is they're finding ways to improve their lives. So if we just ask this question of people who are in the program compared to people who are not in the program, we also should not really be satisfied that we've established a causal link of, from the program to impact. Okay, so this is, it's that recognition, and this is one of the biggest challenges in social science in general, is how to set up that type of causality. And one of the things that we do is we establish that causality by doing randomized trials. This is the same approach that we would use for prescription drugs, for instance, when we do prescription drugs and we want to find out, does this particular medicine, you know, help alleviate colds or prevent some disease or whatever the case is, we go through a prescription drug randomized trial to test that out. And this is the same exact approach that we are taking to the fight against poverty. And this is the heart of what our organization is about, is setting up studies of that nature, of that high quality around the world, across sectors, from microfinance to corruption, to education, to health, et cetera, to learn across all these different ideas which ones are actually causing the changes that we're aiming to see happen. So in the space of microcredit, just to give you kind of a little bit of a punchline, what we've learned recently, and recently there have been several studies that have come out just in the past few years that we did, that have, I think, really opened up a lot of eyes to what microfinance is really all about and how best to do microfinance. So microcredit, this, the program I told you about, for the longest time had been put forward as an almost panacea against poverty, raised lots and lots of money on huge promise. It turns out that not everybody is a born entrepreneur. And a lot of times people are using loans for other things. And that's actually okay, that's a good thing. But it just means we need to change a little bit the way we think about what the promise of microcredit is. The promise of microcredit is about expanding people's choices so that they have the ability to borrow to accelerate consumption, to absorb a shock if something bad happens to them, and to invest in enterprise. But it's not a singular story of enterprise growth the way it had been sold. And what's really important is the minute we accept that, and the minute we realize, and we've seen this now in the data and the studies, that a lot of the uses are for things that are not about enterprise growth, then it should make us pause and say, well, wait a second, is credit then the best thing? In there are a lot of situations, savings is gonna be much better. So take for an example, somebody who is borrowing to pay for school fees. That's a known expense. Right? They're going to have to pay it in July, let's say, depending on the country, and they know they have to pay that. If someone takes out a loan to pay for those school fees and then pays it down over the 6 months following, they're going to end up paying a lot more in total for those school fees than if 6 months before the school fees were due, they were given access to a really good, safe savings account and saved up for it. The difference in terms of food on their table at the end of the year is huge. The minute you are not spending 72% on your loan and instead are saving in a bank account, it's a huge difference just on paper. And likewise, when we've seen studies that have carefully measured the impact of credit and carefully measured the impact of giving people access to savings, we find bigger impacts on the savings side. Similar results on insurance, which I won't go into, showing high promise on insurance. This is not to say credit is bad, but it's to say that we need to think more holistically about the full suite of financial services that are offered and realize that not everybody is well suited for a loan, and some are gonna be better for savings and some in insurance, and we need to understand better what the needs of the poor are. Why do they need a loan in the first place? And the minute we understand that why, it gives us ideas for other types of services that might actually be better off. So that's the first theme of the book is focused about on this evaluation question and explaining how we go about doing this. The second theme of the book focuses a lot on behavioral economics and understanding more about how issues that are relevant for us in America, Hong Kong, developed countries around the world, are often also very relevant for the poor. So one example, it's just one of the examples in the book, is how we deal with temptation. And when we understand better how we deal with temptation, it can shed insight to how to design programs for the poor as well as for ourselves. So let me give you an example from my, how am I doing on time, by the way? Okay.
Two more minutes.
Okay. Okay, so let me give you an example. What I mean by temptation here is we all have different temptations in life. I think that's probably true for just about everyone. It's going to be different, right? Some might be food, some might be wine, some might be smoke, cigarettes, some might be they work too much, some might be they don't work enough. Whatever the case is, we have temptations where there's things that we say we want to do differently, but then when the time comes, we don't do it differently, and we later regret it. And one idea that we talk about in the book, and we have different examples from different facets of life, is the ability to assign have commitment devices. Commitment devices are ways that people can increase the price of their vice in order to help guide them towards decisions that they themselves want to have. And we show how this way of thinking about the way we design businesses or nonprofits can help farmers in Kenya invest more in fertilizer for their farm, something that they all say they want to do, but when the time comes, they often don't. It can help people, and we did a study in the Philippines that helped people stop smoking. And we have a website that we have launched, it's around the world, but it's biggest in the United States, that where people can write a contract to lose weight. Now, let me give you an example of my personal life that kind of gives you a very micro example of what exactly I mean. So I like wine. I'm not nearly as obsessed as I think Tom was describing the wine committee here. No offense to anyone here. I hope I didn't just get you in trouble. but I like wine, and I also really like dessert. And I'm just one of these people with these metabolisms that just kind of turned the other way on me when I was about 25 years old and made it so that I always have to be careful about what I'm eating, otherwise I gain weight. Okay, so if I go to a fancy restaurant and I have not had wine, I've just had a nice piece of fish, salad, and the dessert menu comes, and it's $12.95 US for a nice dessert that's really tempting, I will resist and I will say no. Okay, but if I've had half a bottle of wine, when that dessert menu comes, I say yes. So what's the consequence of this for me? I drink a lot less wine than I'd like to. And it's not because I don't want wine, it's because I don't want dessert. Right? So when the wine menu comes in the beginning, I think ahead and I think to myself, okay, I want the wine, but I know what I'm going to do in an hour when the dessert menu comes if I drink this wine. So I pass on the wine and I order iced tea, all because I don't want to eat dessert. Now, isn't that stupid? So here's what I do now. If I went out to dinner with Tom, and I would do this with Tom, you have to have the right personality on the other end. That's a compliment, but I would turn to Tom and I would say, Tom, if I order dessert, I owe you $1,000. Okay, so now, even if I've had half a bottle of wine in me, am I going to spend $1,012.95 on dessert? No. If I've had a whole bottle of wine in me, I'm still not going to spend that much money on dessert. Right? And so what does this do? This allows me to drink my wine. And then I'm happy. I'm better off. So what have I done? I've increased the price of my vice. I've done it in my own little unique way in this particular microcosm. But there's other ways of doing this that fit more for an overall lifestyle. So as an example of what we did in the in Kenya with fertilizer, the simple issue was that at harvest season, the farmers get all their money from their cash crops. And 3 months later, that money's frittered away when it comes to planting season to put money into fertilizer. So what did they do? We offered them prepaid fertilizer vouchers that committed to buying fertilizer. Now, it doesn't actually commit them to use it, which is what's interesting. But when planting season came, they got the fertilizer and they didn't sell it, they used it. In the Philippines, we offered people a bank account. They put the money they were using for cigarettes into the bank account, and in 6 months, the bank came and gave them a little test that they urinate, a little stick they urinate on, and it shows whether they've been smoking. If they had been smoking, their money goes to a local orphanage. If they succeeded in stopping, then they keep their money. Right? This is a totally voluntary program. They only do this if they want to stop smoking. And it made them 30 percentage points more likely to stop smoking compared to the control group. In the United States, people do this for losing weight. You can go to the website, You say, I'm going to put up $1,000. I'm going to lose 10 pounds over the next 4 months. And if I don't, then you can send my money off to the George Bush Presidential Library. And that's the most popular option, is to choose a charity they hate. We give them both sides. We're not, you know, we're agnostic politically. We're not going to choose sides there. I'm just giving you the facts. So, you know, the Bill Clinton Library is up there and the George Bush Presidential Library is up there, and it's about an 80-20 vote in terms of people opting for the Bush Library. But we give people all sorts of options. And in fact, in the UK, it's available where you can choose Premier League teams. People can commit their money to go to Arsenal, Tottenham, Chelsea, and Man U. Again, they're choosing their most hated football team. And if they fail to reach their goal, and somebody holds them accountable, then their money goes off to whatever it is that they said they hate. So this is an example of a basic idea, a basic way of thinking, a why question. Why do we have problems achieving some of our goals? Sometimes it's because our vices are too cheap. And then thinking about how we can change those prices can help us solve goals, solve problems. And this applies to the fight against poverty as well as it applies to the struggles we face in our everyday life. And so that's one of the themes of the book that we try to shed insight in, is to show that some of these struggles that we deal with in poverty programs, it's not so different than what we face in our everyday life. Not to say everything is like that. There are some issues that clearly are particular to being poor that are just not problems that we face in developed countries. And but there are some lessons that do transcend.
Okay, questions. I think that you should feel that you can ask any questions tied to any of the issues surrounding efforts to alleviate poverty around the world to Professor Carlin, because he's probably considered them at one point or another. So we don't have that many speakers who come here who have his expertise. So really, this is your opportunity. Now, who might have a question? Everyone raise your hand who might. OK, there's one over here. There's two over here. Are there any people over? There's one over here. Any over there? This is your chance to register on my radar. So please raise your hand if you think you might have one. All right, so we have four. So let me just work my way around the room. I will recognize you guys. So there was one over here. Who was? Yes, please. And identify yourself at the beginning of your question. Can we get a mic right over here?
Hi, I'm from the South China Morning Post. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm highly prejudiced against development economics. But it strikes me.
By the way, that's terrific. I would love this conversation to be an attack on anything, because it just would make it a much more interesting and provocative. You know, the goal here is not to suck up to the speaker. It's to let him respond to the issue. So that's terrific. Thank you.
I don't deny it. I think there's no doubt that some poverty relief programs help a lot of people, just like any number of NGOs and charities. But development economics as a branch. I think economics has often been described as a dismal science. I think development economics is even more dismal than most other sub-branches of economics. If I'm right, there's not a single people, economy, or a country that is poor became rich or less poor by following precepts done out by the most respected people in your discipline. In fact, I think countries that got rich, China, India, Japan, and Korea, Singapore, or maybe even Rwanda, probably work against many of the precepts that are dictated or prescribed by your peers. So again, I'm prejudiced.
But what precepts are you talking about that you think are wrong?
I think in terms of, there was a time when the Washington Consensus was the dominant mode before the financial crisis that opened up your economy, let the foreigners in, open up your financial and economic institutions and channels, let all the foreign bankers in. Don't control capital flows, that sort of thing. And if I also remember reading, in Hong Kong, there was one development economist, I can't remember the name, was that Hong Kong should be a basket case, according to the more traditional economics, because of all the lack of resources and the education, and yet somehow I managed to get rich.
So I don't actually pretend to be an expert in macroeconomic issues. So I, you know, the focus that I have is really on micro policies about, if we're going to provide a social service to individuals, that's going to be about improving education, improving schools, improving health systems, offering microfinance. What what are the lessons here about what works, what doesn't, and why, which is a very different question than macroeconomic, monetary policy, international trade policy. So, you know, I'm really not trying to skirt your question. You know, I'm just saying that that's not what this is about, and that's not what the search that I'm describing is about. And I'm not accepting nor denying what you're saying in any way.
We'll try to get someone else here who you can attack for all of those policies. That would be excellent. There are people to blame that you can blame, but maybe
what I would agree with you in the attack is that that debate actually has distracted us in some sense, because that debate is focused on the issues which are less tractable and less answerable. And there's a lot more that we have, a lot of progress that has been made in the past 10 years by saying, well, you know what, you know, let's let that debate happen, but meanwhile, all these programs on the ground, let's figure out what's going on with them.
Over, who was, please raise your hands again, over here. And then there were two other, who were the other, okay. Let's start there, and then I'll go to you next, and I think there's someone over here. Please.
Hi, I'm also from the South China Morning Post. My name is To Han Shi. Recently, I mean, some of the middle-ranking but large countries like the BRICS or whatever have shown incredible success as reducing poverty, like Brazil, Vietnam, and China. Do you have any comments on this and explanation why these such countries have been so successful at reducing poverty?
So, you know, it is. So, I mean, as a general statement, growth is good for poverty. I think there's clear evidence on that. It doesn't mean that it's universally good, that with growth we also can see exacerbation of inequality within countries. But you know, what we have seen in each of those countries is a clear industrial policy which caused a lot of growth and a lot of business investment. Now, having said that, in each of those countries, there's a lot of poverty. So I by no means would say that we have solved poverty in those countries. And it just goes to show that there's a lot of macroeconomic issues which can influence poverty. But at the same time, each of these countries struggles very much with what types of policies to run on the ground for those who are poor. And that's what this work is about, is helping to understand those types of programs. Some of those countries are further along in the search for evidence on what works and what does not, and then others.
Over here, there was, yep, please. And I think there's, please raise your hand so I can know where I'm going. Ah, I'm sorry. Oh, and over here, okay. So after you, we're gonna go to Tara and then around.
Thanks. Hi, my name is Yana. I'm a co-founder of an organization that works with social businesses, and a lot of them are working toward alleviating poverty. So we look a lot at what works and what doesn't when we decide what opportunities we're going to support. Just yesterday, I read a commentary that attacked the media and journalists in particular for, quite harshly, for never talking about what works and what doesn't in poverty alleviation. The statement was that whenever, you know, there's so much bad news already, that if you're going to talk about someone doing something good, you never want to make it sound bad, but the reality is, people don't read about this in the newspaper. They read about a lot of models that sound good, but it's never a balanced point of view or an assessment of what works and what doesn't. So I think my question is about what role you see the media journalists playing in this, and what's a good way for to get this out to the general public? How can people know what works and what doesn't in other ways?
So, first of all, I agree that it's critical for to get the word out, and that's actually the reason I wrote the book. It's not to say I'm like a small drop in a huge ocean, but that was exactly the motivation, was recognizing that the academic research, which is carefully answering this question, is not readily available to many people. Now the book is going to be outdated in a few years. I like to think that's my hope, and so one of the missions of our nonprofit is to continue that communication. We've recently started the Proven Impact Initiative, which continuously tries to update and provide specific lessons about what ideas are rising to the top, and those ideas new ideas will get put on, and some ideas as better ideas come forward might be taken off, and we're working hard to reach out to media to help get these lessons to media so that they can report on these lessons. I do think that there's certainly a contingent of media that are not doing that are. You see media going both ways. I mean, you know, it's striking to me how, you know, within 30 seconds of being interviewed, I can usually tell that I would say half the media interviews I have, within 30 seconds, I can tell there's an agenda. that the person is wanting to write a glossy piece about something that's wonderful and doesn't want to hear that it might not actually be good if there's not clear evidence. And you know, and half the interviews I have come from someone who just wants to talk about how the world is corrupt and nothing works,
and what
which I find very sad. But that I'm just speaking from my experience.
And what percent is in between? Genuinely curious.
No, I would say about half the interviews I engage in, I feel like from the very beginning I can.
Oh, half.
Put,
so
I can
half
e- I either put they either have an agenda or they don't. I'm just roughly speaking, and then I couldn't tell you which half.
No,
yeah.
You had a question too, but I said, okay, please. And identify yourself as well.
Hi, my name is Abby. I work with Synergy Social Ventures, also with Yana. It's the organization that supports social ventures in Asia. One question I had regarding the randomized control trials is, given the oftentimes the small budgets of these nonprofits and these organizations, what do you suggest in terms of how do they implement their M&E programs so that they can have proven impact despite, you know, maybe not having the expertise in doing an RCT?
Right. Great question. And it applies, just to be clear, well beyond social businesses. It also applies to just, take a nonprofit that is working, doing, you know, inspiring work in five villages and or two villages or one village or one community in a slum in an urban setting. My honest opinion is that we see too much of a push in that situation to establish whether they're working. That if there's a small NGO or small enterprise that doesn't have a clean way of showing whether it's working or not, then I want to see two things. One is I want to see that they're measuring what the inputs that they're putting in to see that they're doing the things they say they're going to do. And I want to see that they're either choosing an idea that has been shown in other settings to be effective. Right, because we shouldn't be seeing a randomized trial done for every single thing, every single program. But if we've seen that the idea works and we understand the context and the why, and this goes back to exactly Tom's point about the why, if we know that why and we can see that this setting over here is similar, then great, you don't need a randomized trial. Just go do it because we've already learned over here that it works. The other setting in which we don't want to see groups doing randomized trials is when it's really early stages, when they're fumbling around trying to figure out how to do something, it's innovative, they're toying with something, it's really in the operational iron out the kinks phase. That's too early. Go and kind of explore and figure this out better, and then when it's ready to be at a scale and if it's truly something new and innovative, then there are ways of doing the randomized trial. But I think a lot of entities that I see, I actually think, and I say this, and as you, I'm sure you've surmised, I'm a kind of a data guy. Like, I like data, and I think we need more data. But I'm also struck by how many organizations are pushed to get useless data. And I often find myself in conversations, including a breakfast that I had this morning, in which my advice was, no, you get less data. This is not showing you impact. So don't do it. Don't waste your resources. Measure inputs. Measure inputs to make sure that you are doing the things you say you're going to do. But if you can't get at that counterfactual, if you can't answer the question of what would have happened had your program not existed, don't go following people over time to see whether they're got out of poverty. Just make sure that your organization's doing what it said it was going to do.
Sorry. Hi. You mentioned in your opening remarks that there are a lot of sets of commonalities in terms of how people behave, whether they're poor or not. What are the things that you think are unique to poor people that you can use to alleviate poverty? And can we as academics or journalists or professionals even understand those unique features?
So there are many. I mean, like I said, there's some things that transcend and some do not. So, you know, as an example, credit markets is a very, very simple example. And access to good savings. Financial, you know, we all, I'm going to guess, everybody at this table, the difference in the interest rate at which you can borrow and save is not huge, right? That's not true for the poor. The spread between those two numbers is huge. For many of the poor, they can only save at a negative interest rate, and they can only borrow at 50 to 100%. That causes huge changes in behavior. And that's an issue which does not apply to the rich. When I can, you know, I can save at, you know, 5%, and I can borrow at, well, 1.25% on my home equity, right? So, I mean, that's just not something that the poor have access to, and that causes huge differences in the way we need to think about everything from education to health, right? It's not just a finance thing, but it has implications for vaccinations and immunizations. and paying for school and things like this, because it's not so easy to just say, take out a student loan to pay for college. You can't do that when you don't have access to credit and savings markets. So those types of issues do not transcend. And so that's one set of examples. The other I would say that is fundamentally different is an issue of risk. Right? So again, risk and the ability to make mistakes, I think is a key issue. If I mess up, if I make the wrong decision tonight at doing something and it cost me $100, my life is not going to change. Right? I won't even notice it. If you're poor and you screw up and you lose $10, that's going to change something. But that money is going to come from somewhere. And so what it points out is that when we are weak, when we do make mistakes, either cognitive or succumbing to temptation, the consequences when you're poor are just that much darker. And similarly, that's not just about mistakes, but just about risk in general. Like if it's bad rainfall, what's the big deal for me, right? So maybe I'll ruin my shoes. If it's bad rainfall and you're poor, you ruin your crop. Very different beast. So the way we are able to cope with risk has huge differences and, again, manifests itself in many different ways that are fundamentally different. So for the poor, for instance, we're doing studies in Ghana that look at how risk of rainfall makes people less likely to invest in their farms. And we're finding that by removing rainfall risk, by giving them rainfall insurance, we see investment go up. This is a huge finding, and frankly, it's the type of thing that wouldn't apply to the wealthy who have better risk management tools available to them.
Oh, see, the questions are really popping, and we're almost out of time. So could you be very, very brief, state who you are, and just 10 seconds.
Nick Gary Villard from the Harvard Kennedy School. And my question is just about the adherence within the program group of your randomized controlled trial, or just adherence within the program once it's been taken out of a trial and just being used, and whether there are characteristics that define those people who do stick with the voucher or with the escrow account, wherever their money's been put, and if there aren't, and if you can then do follow-up to try to help those people who, through whatever fault of their own, can't stick with this program that is purely voluntary. Just your thoughts on that.
Sure. So, I think that's, I put this in there's two basic thoughts to share. One is that, very few programs, when we report in a very simplistic way average impacts, like the key first question to ask is kind of similar in what you're asking, which is, okay, average is good, but I care a lot about heterogeneity too. I care a lot about whether did it help everyone by that same average amount, or were some people helped a lot and other people less? And usually the answer is the second. And then the good evaluations help understand that, and then follow-on research can then say, okay, for the people who weren't helped, what do we do, right? And maybe there's something else. This is the type of iterative collaboration that, as an organization, we love to have when we're able to test out different questions in the operation of an organization, because it isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all answer to anyone. And the smoking is a perfect example. Only 1 out of 9 people opened up those accounts, right? So it was great for that 1 out of 9. But 8 out of 9 didn't open the account. What do you do for them? Right? So it's clearly something else. Now, maybe over time they would learn and the 1 out of 9 would tell their friends and it'd be 2 out of 9 or 3 out of 9, but we're never going to make it to 9 out of 9. That's just not the right product for literally everyone. So it's still, there's definitely a question that remains on the table about what to do for those who will not open up such an account to help them stop smoking, just to use that example.
Boy, there are so many. Please, like the far side, and then I'll do you next, and I'll see if we have time for you. I'm sorry.
Hi, my name is Hanfoot von Hindenburg. I work for IFC International Finance Corporation, not related to the building here in Hong Kong, I like to emphasize. It's part of the World Bank group, and we give loans and advice to private sector, to companies in developing countries. And we struggle a lot with this question of how do you measure impact. Development impact is our big question and theme. And it's easy when we support a project that gives access to water for 10,000 people. 10,000 people have been helped. You have achieved development impact. It's much harder when you support a microfinance institution or a bank to provide better products for SMEs. How many people have been reached? Have people been really helped? Is a tougher question. The big question, I think, to you and to us as well is how do you create impact that's scalable, that's huge? And I think you sort of admitted essentially in your comments so far, but I still want to ask about it again, that your programs and your examples are micro on the micro level. So the question is, how do we, not help just 100 people in the Philippines not to smoke, but how do we turn the Philippines into a developed country? How can you scale up what you're suggesting? How can maybe also the measurement tools that you're suggesting be used to transform entire economies?
Okay, so let me be clear. When I said micro, I don't agree with what you're saying. So when I'm talking micro versus macro, I'm talking about the level of the policy, not the scale of the intervention. So when I was talking about macro and this not being in the macro space, I'm talking about monetary policy, government fiscal policy, taxation policy at the macro level. The two examples you gave, we do evaluations exactly on those topics, and they are very scalable, right? It is a question, we'll do an evaluation of a program that works with SMEs on the finance side that works with hundreds and hundreds or thousands of SMEs. Same thing with water. You can do programs that deal with water sanitation across hundreds and thousands of villages. So there's nothing about what I'm talking about that isn't scalable if the evaluation is done right. What I mean by macro is literally like, what's the right monetary policy, legal systems, things of that nature become much harder beasts. Buzz.
Was that the wrong answer? I've never heard that. I didn't even know we had an alarm system here. Maybe there's a fire, jump off the balcony.
The two examples of things you gave just are very much in the space of the types of things that could be evaluated using this approach. And I think in terms of scalability versus micro versus large, in terms of the number of people being reached, there's clearly lessons that we can learn on the smaller scale of programs that are in the kind of pilot incubator phase, where there's nothing about that program that is unique to being a service for 100 firms that wouldn't apply to 1,000 or 10,000. But there might be operational differences about how to run an organization at a large scale versus a small scale. And that's something that could undergo further research. But that's research about how to run an organization and how to set up accountability systems to make sure that things are being done in the same way on a large scale as they are in a small scale. And that is something that we do engage in as an organization. And take clean water as an example. We did some tests on a fairly small level in terms of number of recipients of chlorine dispensers to improve the quality of water at wells. And now we're taking this to thousands of villages and setting up an experiment over the way the chlorine dispensers are brought to the wells so that we can learn which methods of supplying these chlorine dispensers is more sustainable at the community level. And that's being done at thousands and thousands of villages.
Maybe this will be our last question. I'm sorry about that. Again, please introduce yourself. And
shall I make it a good one? Peter Bennett, I'm retired. It seems to me that a lot of people would want to give more to charitable institutions and for development in various parts of the world, but are held back by the poor media attention highlighting poor decision-making on investments. So there's not a poor return. So there's an issue with public perception, and media plays a role in this. And secondly, why don't people try to get the message across better when you can have programs like The Apprentice or other programs that are semi-reality TV show? It's what a lot of people watch. It's what a lot of people talk about. It's what's covered in the media. And if you had programs like those or some other reality TV shows or whatever, it might be able to get over the message in a different way than we have it today.
So I think the first part of your question, the answer to that I have is that is one of the reasons for evaluation, that it is to get over the skeptics, to get over the arguments that it's all failed. To say, well, look, just because you can point to your finger at one thing that turned out not to work does not mean that aid is failing. It means that you need to pay attention to what works and what doesn't and support the things that do. And that is a message that we need to get out to the media so that when media write articles that are bad about one entity, that's not the takeaway, is look, see, so give up and lose hope. The second about reality TV, it's funny you should mention that because we've had this idea for a while about doing a reality TV show about our organization where we do something that's like some combination of The Amazing Race and The Apprentice. We've never found the production company that would take us on, but we would love to do it. So if you know someone, we'd love to. We think it'd be a really interesting way of bringing some of these field projects to light to people around the world. And you know, but we've been told it's very expensive.
Wow, spectacular idea. Okay, so thank you very much. I think when you want to talk about inefficiency, the first thing you have to consider is that Dean Carlin has a great new book out, and we are unable to provide it to you today because there's no bookstore in Hong Kong that apparently sells it. But this is, but I guess you can find it on Amazon.
It's available on Amazon, yes.
And when did it come out?
April 14th.
April 14th, so it's fairly new. Dean Carlin is going to be on sabbatical this year, he didn't say, but he's going to be on a worldwide study project, including, what, the Philippines, Ghana, Uganda, what other countries are you?
Chile, Turkey, London.
So it won't be my response, but I hope in a year when he finishes it, he can come back and talk to you all about all the things that he's seen that have changed his views on what functions and what does not function. So maybe Tara could handle that. We've also seen that even if you give the most rambling question or comment like I did, he's able to bring at least one thing and maybe two from what you said that actually has some relevance to something. So that by itself, given the multitude of anti-poverty programs and all the confusion that's around, is a great gift. We need some rays of light in many of the vexing issues that we all face in this world. So I'd like to give applause to Professor Carlin for his comments and hope to hear from him again.
Thank you, everyone.
You can. We have a photo, but then you can mob them with other questions if you'd like. We have another one of these photos. We have no idea what happens to these photos. Yeah, I think this is fantastic.
We don't have. We really tried them.
You don't have to go on your diet.
We had some.